Welcome to the SaaS Sales Performance Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to be on the cutting edge of SaaS tech sales. We provide the tools you need to take advantage of the rapidly changing sales environment. We bring you the leading experts on the front lines of SaaS sales and distill down our famous masterclasses into bite-sized practical tips. Your hosts will be Ash Ali and Matt Milligan. And on this podcast, we will be transforming your ability to sell more and smash your targets.
Welcome back to another episode of the SaaS Sales Performance Podcast. And we're continuing our recent theme in today's show of inviting super experienced revenue leaders on to have a no holds barred conversation about big topics that are facing a number of revenue leaders in the current climate. Today's show is going to be no different. We have another amazing revenue leader on the show today, a revenue leader that I've been connected to for the past couple months via the Stage 2 Capital Network. Today's guest has been in revenue leadership positions for over 20 years. He's led teams at notable brands such as Marqeta, filled roles at CRO level, has been through ups, downs, 2001, 2008. Really excited to welcome today's guest, who is Ruzbeh Ratabi. Ruzbeh, really pleased that, you know, Sam at Pavilion has put us in touch, and really great to connect and have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Matt, and appreciate the intro. And yes, it's been a unique journey, but one that you constantly learn and look back on and say, I would have done this differently. And I think that's what comes with age. And I love what you and the UHubs team are doing about sales enablement, education, and learning and development, especially as we head into the next foray of the SaaS technology sales environment. So thanks for having me, Matt.
Absolute pleasure. And looking forward to today's conversation. Hey, look, that leads us quite nicely onto one of the core topics we're going to be covering. You know, we're going to be talking about what it takes to sell in a down market. And, you know, you've been through multiple cycles in your own sales career. You know, before we jump onto that, Ruzbeh, it'd be great if you could help the listeners understand a little bit more about your journey. You know, how did you get into sales? How have you made your way into sales leadership?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm a reformed accountant by trade. I always wanted to be CPA. My grandfather's my idol. And he was an accountant for UNICEF back in Iran. And so I did that for 7 months. And I realized that sitting in an office for 100 hours a week, back then looking at, you know, literal pieces of paper or DOS matrix, you know, screens was not for me. A friend of mine recruited me to go work at ADP, the largest global payroll company in the world. I still, you know, admire my time there. Really good foundation of learning, development, really good understanding of what a sales process is, how to structure the different prospective businesses, and how to build the fundamentals of payroll. And I sat out the entire, you know, you mentioned the dot-com boom of 01 and bust. I actually sat on the sidelines. I lived in San Francisco. I didn't join in. And then when it kind of cratered in 2003, I got introduced to a company that was in payments and fintech through, they were actually our provider of a solution at ADP. I met the COO, we hit it off. His name's Gary Palmer, we're still friends. And the crazy thing is, I took the leap into the startup world much after my friends went back into the big company. And from there, I really fell in love with fintech, payments, money movement, all things to do with checks and so forth. I think part of that is rooted in the fact that when we moved here from Iran, my parents, my father could not buy a home because he didn't have established credit, even though he had a successful engineering business there. So even at a young age, I understood that financial service ecosystem, you know, has gives and takes or puts and takes. And so the last 20 years, I've been focused on a variety of GTM roles, whether it's in sales, business development, customer success at Marqeta, as you mentioned, and a CRO role as well. And so I think I've seen ups and downs. And I think the biggest thing is that as we head into this next cycle, it's going to take a lot more of an astute go-to-market thought to win business. That doesn't mean just for sales. That means sales, business development, partnerships, customer success, onboarding, revenue operations, the whole gamut. I think the one area that's going to get really interesting that is not under revenue or GTM is corporate development. I think the M&A world's going to get really hot here in the next year. So my journey has been working with a lot of great leaders, a lot of thoughtful mentors, and learning from them. And we can talk about some of the ups and downs, that mistakes I've made, that I'd like to share some of the wisdom and get your thoughts.
Would love to. That sounds like a plan. What a ride. I guess it's fair to say not many sales professionals will begin their careers aspiring to be accountants. and then move in that way. Having said that, one of the things that we talk a lot about is the importance of revenue leaders to be, you know, literate with numbers and be good on Excel. You know, this is one of the things we hear a lot in like the Pavilion community, right? How do you see that dynamic play out? Do you think some of the skills you maybe started developing when you were looking to be an accountant have kind of helped you in your sales career?
Yeah, I think there's two things there. From a personal standpoint, working as an accountant, understanding taxes, my goal was to work at Ford and Chevy and really help them build a supercar that could compete with European automobiles at American prices. But I realized that I didn't want to live in Detroit, so that didn't go anywhere. Nothing wrong with Detroit, it's just colder than California. But I think knowing the financial numbers and knowing the insides of how the books work, if you will, is really important for revenue and go-to-market, and it spans the entire group. Like a marketing department should know what a customer's P&L is if they have it published. They should understand what their marketing spend is. A salesperson should know what their margin or their ideal margin is, because if you're selling a solution that's 40% more or 30% more, that's incrementally better from a fit, you're going to have to cross the threshold with the CFO, especially now. The CFOs are all going to be involved in the sales process, and you have to win them over. So I think everyone in a go-to-market role, the entire, if you fan out, should understand the compository, if you will, of a financial statement, whether that's balance sheet, cash flow statement, any of those aspects, margin, et cetera. The more you understand, the better you're going to be able to do your job.
One of my mentors would say to me, like, you know, business is pretty simple. It's, you know, like business is really like a sport. And it's just about like optimizing the numbers on the leaderboard. Like, how do you move the numbers up, and how do you keep revenue going up, and how do you make sure your costs aren't going up as much at the same time?
I think especially now, one of the things that when I started working in venture-backed companies in 2003, what some of the key metrics that fell off over the next 12 years were revenue per employee. That was something that was tracked in the mid 2000s, because it was how capital efficient are you to how much revenue are you building? And are the butts in seats, if you will, appropriate for that? The other is, are you building efficiently from what is your capacity model? Are people really at capacity, or are you hiring because you want to build a bigger team or you want to promote people? Those are the things that are going to really come back into the foray. Sadly, the downside of that is you're seeing a ton of layoffs across all of tech. I think people are starting to think about that differently.
But that's so true. So, like, because that metric disappeared into thin air. You know, like I always remember Apple would always talk about revenue per employee, wouldn't they? It's almost like we lost our way in some degree.
Well, I think we did for a couple of reasons. 0% interest rates, that'll make anyone lose their mind because everyone's got free money. And then I think the other thing that happened is that there was so many good technology companies being created that it was like, okay, and we'll get into this later. I think the vitamin versus the painkiller. And it's like, okay, how many tools do I need? How many services do I need? So it became a compounding effect of, I'll buy your services if you buy mine almost. And that horse trading led to a lot of teams being built. I think the other thing is that as much as the tools and the solutions advance from a product and edge standpoint, I think the amount of work that they have to do because everything went to the cloud and they didn't control that, they're easier to launch, harder to control when things are in the cloud. But when you have a data center, no one's going to implement a data center. Very few people would. That was yours. You literally walked into someone's building. And their first floor was a refrigerated room with a bunch of racks of hardware. I think those two things will have compounded the effective need for more engine, more product resources.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I think they're really valid themes. I mean, if you cast your mind back to, let's say, global financial crisis 2008, you know, someone who sold through that period, I guess for those either, you know, leaders listening to this who haven't led through a downturn, or individual contributors who have maybe started their career 5 years ago, who only sold through the glory times. Help us understand, like, what are you seeing at the moment in the market that's similar? And then what are you seeing, perhaps, like, some differences this time around?
Yeah, I think there's two things that I would say. 2008 made everyone hit pause. It was a hard reset. There was a lot of things paused. I worked at a company called Blackhawk Network. We were the largest gift card distribution company in the world. You know, I joined when we were $25, $30 million in revenue, and we built it out to $2 billion. But it paused everything. Our numbers went down by 60-70%. Granted, we were heavily retail focused. I think the two things that hard pause made people realize that I have to build really good tech. And I think it was the introduction to really, really unique solutions. And if you look at the companies that were founded from 08 to 2012, there are some headliners: Stripe, Square, DoorDash. because people really saw a fit in the market for a solution that hadn't been there before. At the same time, you have things that people were like, I'll go take a gig worker job. I'll go drive for Instacart. I'll go drive for DoorDash. And then all of the things that need to support DoorDash and Instacart: technology, payments, onboarding, SaaS tools, HR management tools, all of those things spawned from that. So I'd say right now there's a lot of good companies being built and across all of tech, but I think that the hard reset made everyone rethink. I think the difference right now is that people are going to have the sales cycle stopped, so that everything paused. Right now, I think you're just going to see everything elongate to 1.5 to 2x of whatever it would take. If your sales cycle was 3 months, just plan on it being 5. If it took you 100 phone calls to book 20 meetings, I think now it's going to take you 200. Because the attention is so focused on the macro environment that you're going to have to fight for space in people's mind and hearts to win them over. So the hard pause almost let everyone take a break, and not that anyone did, and create things. Right now, there's a lot of great companies being created. But to the ICs, I'd say do more work, do more investigative research, find out who the right prospects are. Don't be hopeful about opportunities, and double book your pipeline. In the old days, you'd say like in sales, 3 to 4x of your pipeline to get your quota. I think right now you might want to crank that up to 4 or 5 because of the time gap, not because people won't make decisions, but simply because of the elongated sales. And the last thing I'd say is you're selling into the CFO suite, whether you like it or not. If you're selling a SaaS tool in MarTech or RevTech or payments or FinTech, the CFO is still seeing your proposal, whether it's through email, whether it's through third party. So learn how to build an advocate inside the company. Learn who your saboteur is inside the sales process. Learn who your executive sponsor is very early on and what their buying criteria.
I think it's spot on, and so spot on that we just recorded a future episode of this show with a 25 years experienced CFO asking him those exact questions. And so we'll keep you posted on that. But it's spot on. It's exactly what we're seeing in the market right now.
I think it's one of those things that's unique. And the other thing is, if you reflect back to all the way back to the dot-com bust, when the VCs, it was a different environment. VCs funded those companies. They went public before they were profitable, before they were ready. And if you really look at the intrinsic value of the dot-com boom, what transpired is a lot of that was services and goods that you could get online. What it forced were the big retailers. The reason that all these companies like Webvan and FogDog and Pets.com succeeded is because PetSmart and Macy's and Dick's Sporting Goods and all of them didn't have an e-commerce delivered to my doorstep. Amazon was still kind of like books, sunglasses, purses, not anything you ever want. And that created a different outcome because it only affected a small subset of the ecosystem. Whereas the GFC flattened almost everything because it was bank related. And then this right now is impacting all of our worlds that work in tech. But I have friends that work in industrials, that work in logistics, that work in manufacturing. They're humming right along. Their supply chain stuff got screwed up, obviously, but they're not as impacted.
Let's talk briefly there about sales cycles. You spoke there 1.5 to 2x on everything. Like everything's getting pushed right now. CFO involvement, pretty much every deal, much more scrutiny, more stakeholders involved. The companies that you're advising and consulting at the moment, what are some of the things that you are advocating with them to help them overcome these obstacles and try to get these deals over the line?
Yeah, great question. Phenomenal question. I'd say three things that come to mind. One is, one's got to happen. If you are a small to medium-sized tech firm, I'll say under $30, $35 million in revenue, you should get your CEO or your executive sponsor to find out how to get to the CEO or the CFO or the executive sponsor of the prospect after you've had a couple good calls. Many times people in revenue, whether it's a customer success person, partnerships, whoever it may be, sales, BD, there's a little bit of hesitance to call, you know, the old, I don't want to go over their head. Right now, it's not going over their head. It's air coverage. It's making sure that the CEO of a company, for example, one of my clients, they're working on a really big opportunity with a company that's using a competitor that's well established. They're using a payments company, FIS, that's been around for 60 years. The CEO, my suggestion to her was the CEO needs to get in there and talk to the CEO of the company. They're close in locale, find a place. Because what you always do is you'll always be able to get to the net of what is your decision-making process? Are you still going down this path? And are you truly just trying to get a better offer from your current provider? Because the last thing we all want to be used as in any business is a stalking horse. And so that's one thing I do. The second I would do is I would have the prospect really qualified. Meaning, like, are you searching for this solution? Are you searching for a competitive bid? If it's core to your business and you already have a provider and you're basically a swap out or replacement sale, and I think a lot of people will rely on that. If you're selling against behemoths, if you're selling against IBM, SAP, Oracle, Stripe, Adyen, the big ones in the market, FIS, you're going to really have to understand how deep that pain is for them to make the transition. They're breaking a relationship. They're reestablishing something else. If you frame that in personal context, that's a big step.
I love it. So bring in the air cover early. Figure out how to get your CEO hooked up with the CEO of the company you're selling to. And really focus on qualification. Like, make sure you're not. I always find this interesting, right? Because it's like when pipeline's harder to generate, we almost, as sellers, we can feel the temptation to chase deals a bit harder. And qualification becomes harder to do as ruthlessly, right?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the GFC, one of the biggest mistakes I made was chasing down logos from 2009, 2010. I was chasing down, you know, the Amazons and the Microsofts and Sonys for when I worked at Blackhawk to do some strategic payments partnerships. We got over the finish line, but it took forever because those companies were worried about such macroeconomic aspects to their business. I can't tell you how many times I went to Seattle or to Peninsula over in the Bay Area just to meet with them and get them over the finish line. And one of our executives at the time, Don Kingsrow, was a former colleague of the number two in charge at Microsoft on this initiative. They worked together back in the Atari days. I think you have to sit there and understand the connectivity that's amongst the executives. And you have to understand that there's going to be a lot of false pretenses to buy. Something else I want to ask you. You said we have a tendency when things get tough to either fill our pipeline or remove our first principles and push things into the funnel that maybe is questionable, whether it's a big logo that we're chasing and we shouldn't be, or whether it's a barely qualified opportunity. What are your thoughts on that? You have, like, how do you train and develop the folks that are your clients to make sure that they're not being rigid, but they're also not being too giving?
It's a really good question. So I'll start with what we're doing here internally, first and foremost. And speaking candidly, there was like two deals in our pipeline that were forecast to close at the end of May, which were like non-ICP. They were like really big opportunities. And there were ones that we would like debate several weeks back to back on, like, should this be in? Should this be out? Inevitably, you know, like the temptation is, well, actually the temptation is too tempting to turn down. It's too tempting to qualify out. What if we win it? You know, you have those conversations and then, you know, the reps are talking about, what if we win? You know, what a game changer for the quarter. The reality is, obviously, like, we had no right to win that deal. It was outside our ICP. We should have qualified out from day dot. But hindsight, you know, in those deal reviews, when you go back and look retrospectively at these opportunities, it's always so clear. One of the things we're really doubling down at the moment is just really having good adoption of our qualification criteria. One of the things we use at UHub is Medic, just making sure like we're satisfying Medic criteria at every stage. If a deal is like stalled in a stage and you can't move it forwards, then like, why? Those are two things. I think a couple of other trends we're seeing across other customers at the moment. Some customers are, interestingly enough, we spoke about efficiency at the top of the call. A lot of customers are looking for ways to optimize revenue per head in any which way they can. So we're seeing quite a lot of customers now starting to extend or like almost combine roles. So maybe if they had an account management team, how can they actually start to combine account management and account executives? Quite controversial, particularly if you joined as an IC with like a new business target and now you've been told that you're going to be remunerated on retention as well. You're like, hey, we're seeing quite a lot of that. And then we're also seeing leaders like think about quality over quantity. So it's much more, particularly when it comes to pipeline, thinking about how do we get much more quality pipeline in and then work those deals in the right way, as opposed to just the high volume game. This came up a lot in the CRO summit, which was the Pavilion CRO summit in London a few weeks ago. A lot of leaders rethinking their outbound strategy along those lines. We're not just going to keep hiring more and more SDRs and keep telling them to make more and more calls. We need to take much more of a focused, targeted approach and be more strategic about how we're bringing new opportunities into the pipe.
It's all spot on. I mean, I think you and I are seeing the world the same way. I know you have a lot more of an aperture because you talk to a lot of folks based off fundamentally what UHubs does. And then through your podcast and through Pavilion and Stage 2, which are all great companies that we are both associated with. I think I'll add one thing on the qualifying in and qualifying out. I think if you're a younger startup, again, 30, 35 million and under, you got to apply the 3M. And I don't know if you've heard this, but 3M makes every person take 15% of their work week. Patagonia does it too, but they do it in a different way. 3M makes you work on non-core products to your job or solutions. And so you have to go do something else for 15% of the time. Patagonia, whatever department you work in, you have to test that product for 15% of your week. So if you don't mountain bike and you work on the mountain biking department, you better learn how to ride a bike. And I think it's always one of the coolest things. Like everyone's like, oh yeah, go work in the snowboard department. Just go snowboard 15% of the time. I'm like, yeah, you think it's all, you know, champagne and caviar, but it's not. But going back to what you're saying is like, I would encourage folks to be a little soft on the edges to make sure that they can go chase the big idea. That the big idea, if it matriculates down the pipe where it's not burning too many resources and it does have a near-term impact, near-term being 12 months. Don't go chase something that's going to take a year to implement, 6 months to get on ramp, and then 6 more months. But that'd be my advice. The other thing I think about is, and I'd love your thoughts, I think managing quota attainment and revenue attainment and renewal attainment across the function of go-to-market, I think it's a different animal now that, you know, you read articles that say like 80% in 2023 will be a good year, 85% will be. I think the question is, how do you set the goals going into 24? And how do you make sure that you have the people that are built to sell in the next 2 to 3 years do their job? And you're not being too harsh. There's a good thing about being disciplined and rigorous, but you have to be fair and equitable.
Totally. I saw some content this week in a discussion going on LinkedIn, and it was interesting to hear that there's pushback from reps, like top performers, who for maybe the last 3 to 5 years have been earning incredible amounts of money in a post-product market fit company and not actually having to work as hard because the market's been so flush with cash. Like buying decisions were easy, like times were good. Now they're having to work twice as hard and they're not earning nearly as much money.
Yeah.
That's quite a hard reality, right?
It is. And I think it's, we all get our medicine in different ways. And I think this is one of the things that in the tech sector, SaaS, fintech, payments, massive infrastructure, you know, like Snowflake, Databricks, et cetera. I think we're all getting that taste of medicine. And I think the thing that it's really going to do is it's going to make, I believe product is part of go-to-market. Even though it might not report to it, even though there might be a chief product officer, I think the best companies operate and execute in a flywheel motion where engineering product designs and innovates and thinks, engineering builds, go-to-market sells. Sure, there's a lot of support functions. I'm not diminishing HR, people ops, all of those functions. But if you can get those three leaders and those three teams on the same side of the ball, then I think you're good. You talked about sports. I think it's like football, American football. There's offense, there's defense, and there's special teams. There's a quarterback, there's a linebacker, there's a kicker, there's a punter, there's a long snapper. Each of them are equally important, and each of them serve a purpose in building the right company going forward. But yeah, I think right now people should be in labs just reinventing their product or iterating on their product to retool it to make it that much better. Because the buyers are going to become that much more granular. Before, a nice to have was overlooked. A must have was given time to build. Now it's like, nope, the must haves have to be here by X date and the nice to haves have to be here by Y date.
Yeah, super, super interesting. I love your point as well, by the way, around, you know, I had this exact conversation with my head of product last week. Do we now start to move into a world where actually product teams are incentivized not too dissimilar to sales teams? So you talked about there about like quota attainment, revenue attainment. Yeah. Well, actually, you know, like, are we going to start seeing much more product teams incentivized in similar ways?
And I'll say this, the one thing that Omri Dahan, who's a friend, mentor, former boss, he's the CRO at Mercata, him and I have known each other for 10 plus years. We have an interesting relationship from when they pitched us when I was at Blackhawk to now when we talked yesterday. He said one great quote, the right team is a team. There's a difference between a leadership team and a team of leaders. A team of leaders comes to the job and says, I did my job. I got everything done. And the leadership team comes and says, hey, do we have the job done? Is everything on track? What's going on? How can I lean in and help you? There's a sense of responsibility across the entire team.
That's an amazing quote. I love that. It makes a ton of sense.
And I think as leaders, as you grow in your career, you got to think about these things because it's not so much about who's winning, who's losing, who's up, who's down. If the goal is accomplished, then the goal isn't accomplished for the entire team. You can't say you were successful in GTM if you missed on three big renewals and yet you overattained on partnerships and sales. Like, I think that's a 19, 90s mentality of like every function does their job in silo.
And I guess also highlights the importance of having some really clear company objectives that everyone can get behind.
And simplicity. I don't know about you, but when you're designing goals for your team and you're designing goals for your clients and customers, I always feel that simplicity wins. Don't make it overly complicated. Whatever rubric you use, if you used OKRs, if you use metrics, if you use, you know, team by team functional goals, whatever it may be, but make it very simplistic that if I am a new hire, on day four, I understand my role and my, you know, what and the bigger what of like, I understand that I can contribute to the quota. I can contribute to the revenue. I can contribute to engineering build. And the faster I move and the more efficient I move, the better we accomplish our goals. Some of my experiences have been that, you know, there's been stops along the road. I'll leave the names of the innocent and the guilty out. And I'm guilty of it too. It's not just, don't overcomplicate a rubric and a goal setting process. Make it simple, consumable, and move on from there. I'd love to get your thoughts on what you're seeing these days.
Yeah, I mean, we're big advocates of OKRs. We've actually meshed, like, one of the things we found worked quite well as an earlier stage company is OKRs don't kind of flow down because there's not like layers and layers of hierarchy and different functions. But we set company objectives and then we create what we call a 90-day world. So the objectives can change within that 90 days, but then your weekly leadership cadence is how are we tracking against these objectives and what are the things we need to do to move the needle to get closer. And then everything you do for that 90-day period has to align to one of those 3-4 objectives that you set at the beginning.
I agree. And then I just out of curiosity, so I've done OKRs at a couple stops. Do you believe, well, maybe it's stage dependent, but when I advise my clients on setting goals, I advise them, well, I won't bias the room, sorry. Do you advise them to set OKRs that you can come in at 1.0, or do you advise them where you come in by the scoring methodology where you're trying to, you're not supposed to get the one, you're supposed to miss a little bit because the goal is so outlandish?
We do score out of 100, so that's like a percent. So like to make a simple example, if, you know, like one company objective might be, we want to onboard like 12 new teams on this product. It's pretty simple. You then track a score out of 12, get build up to 100%. Naturally, all of the goals that we're setting are pretty stretch. So it's how do you get that balance right between like team feeling deflated that they haven't quite hit 100 versus the team not aiming high enough because you've set the bar too low? I don't have an answer, respect.
I think it varies by personality and by the desire of the team. That's the way I've guided it. You know, one of my clients is trying to set goals, and their goal is to get to $1 billion in they're in the tax space. So they're focusing on automating ERC refunds. And what we did is we did a backwards math of, okay, you need how many clients do you need on average size, and how do you work up there? And then of course we did the capacity planning on the back end. And I said, if you don't hit $1 billion, which is your moonshot, what is your goal? What is that? And I think in certain industries, you know, in SaaS, it's probably licenses and renewals and payments, a number that we all live to is total payments volume, TPV or GMV, gross merchant volume. And I think that's the big health indicator of, is the system growing? Are the customs growing? Is the system able to handle that growth? And when you work at, like when we worked at Marketo, there's times where we're growing 100% quarter over quarter in the 2018, 2019 days. And you're asking yourself from a tech, from a product, and from a service standpoint, can we attain those goals? And then the same thing on the revenue side. What are we doing to make sure that growth doesn't slow down? So I think nailing your health metrics at an early part of your journey as a company is so important. And you don't need, again, you don't need to complicate it. Have 3 or 4, whether it's seats, whether it's upsells, whatever it may be, but make sure it's germane and good for your business, and that you and your employees can understand it. And that you're managing your board to it too. I think that's the other thing. Your board wants to see the 3 or 4 metrics, at least on a quarterly basis, but maybe on a monthly basis in the early days, so that you can actually say, okay, those are the 3 or 4 ones we're measuring. All of them point to the North Star.
Yeah, I think that's just such a good way to think about it. And pretty much everything we've discussed on the show today, I think this is integral to it, right? You think about quality over quantity, you think about focus, you think about building, you know, a must have rather than a nice to have.
Yeah.
A lot of this all starts with your objective setting, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the nice to haves, I saw one of the folks from stage 2 say something of like, look, I think right now, B2B marketing and tech is going to be the hardest thing. So can we put aside the swag, the events, all of that stuff, and really get into like core product marketing? And I think going back to what you're saying, like hiring a bunch of BDRs isn't going to necessarily gain you what it did 2 to 3 years ago, because people aren't willing to give you 15, 20 minutes or 30 minutes of their time. And I think that's the most interesting piece of this puzzle going forward, is like, where do I push the gas pedal and where do I run lean across the entire company, but specifically in go-to-market? Like, is there a way your CS team can go from managing 20 accounts per person to 40? Is there a way that you could increase the quota and know that you're, you know, 60% of your reps won't hit it, but that hopefully 40% will, and then the 15, 20% rush it, and you can hit the numbers at a macro level, to your point, without everyone feeling deflated? Because part of leadership is inspiring people. Part of leadership is telling people that everything's going to be okay, even though the world's on fire. Just, I have two young daughters. I tell them all the time, everything's going to be okay. They're both going through different things. One's 6, one's 11. Very different, you know, maturation cycles right now. And I'm like, take a deep breath, breathe. It's my job to create some room and space for you here. And you got to go to get all this done. She plays competitive. The older one plays competitive water polo. And they're in the thick of it right now for Junior Olympics. And it's just, it's intense. You know, they're in the pool 3 hours a day. They have training. I wouldn't be doing it at 11. I'll be honest. I did sport by sport, you know, season by season. I couldn't do this 10-month a year thing.
That's super impressive. So you got a future Olympian coming through there.
We'll see. We'll see. What I say is like, look, go do whatever your heart contents. You know, I had a different journey to get to where I'm at. My wife and I have different journeys ourselves. And it's one of those things, you know, if you have the chance to go play and water polo, where we live here in Southern California, is pretty much a religion. You know, it's it'd be the equivalent of ice hockey or lacrosse, or a sport that's near and dear to my heart that we call soccer, but all called football, which is the right name. Over there, where like kids are going to the academies at 9 years old, 10 years old, and getting ingrained in that. It's the same kind of thing on the East Coast with lacrosse and hockey as out here is with soccer and water polo.
Big sports fan myself, I think, but particularly in times like these, right? We've talked about the difficulties and challenges that many of us are going through in the tech space right now, building that resilience early on, and a career in sports, a great way to do that, right?
Yeah. And I think if you think about it, I think the one thing that I love about what's happening right now, and I'm sure you're seeing it, from 2017 to 2021, there was a lot, like a former colleague and I joked that it was like IPO Tuesday. It's like, who's going public today? It was just like in the news cycle. It's like, oh, someone raised $100 million round. Someone raised a $500 million round. And what we kind of missed some steps. We kind of missed the steps of like, okay, here's $15 million. Go spend it. You know, watch your cash burn and see if you can build a product. And then you get your B, and then you go to your C. There were many companies across all of technology that moved so quickly. There was a lot of M&A work that was, you know, at really, really big numbers. Some went through, some didn't. But we missed fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. We almost went from like third grade to high school, or high school to college, without freshman year high school and college. And I think that's the learning lesson that we can all take away, which is, how do we not miss the steps? How do we make sure that we stop, pause, breathe, assess, move on, rather than just work to the next month?
Yeah. And you made a really interesting point around like vitamins versus painkillers in this current environment, right? So, you know, just jumping back to that for a second before we wrap up, is where do you think those tech companies that have come to the realization that they are more on the vitamin side than the painkiller, where do they go? Like, they pivot? Or
I think if you have the data, and you have the information, you have to social proof the heck out of your company. Meaning, you have to have case study after case study. I'll give you an example. When I was at Blackhawk and we were trying to win business over from our competition, a company called Incom, we had a slide that literally outlined what the last 5 customers gained by joining our alliance and our network and our payment solution rather than theirs. And the reason was that you had to have that proof. Going back to our earlier part of the conversation, the CFO is going to ask, give me data that's unassailable, that I can rely on, that I can call the CFO at that company and do a reference check. So I think that if you're a vitamin, you're definitely going to have to figure out how to social proof with data of why company X, A, or B, or C benefited from using your solution. If you can't do that, I think you have to think about a way to get there. If your system or platform or service is definitely not quantifiable, I think you're missing out. I think you got to figure out if you're truly a vitamin that's got 17 competitors or 12 competitors in your landscape, I think you have a lot of hard decisions. I think you have to look in the mirror, ask yourself what we've built. Should we pivot in a new direction? And what have we learned? And what are the crazy ideas that have been in our brains that we haven't pursued? That you could do one of three things. You could move the entire team in that direction. You could reformat, recast the team and move in that direction. Or you could go find someone that's already there and say, hey, we've been working on something unique. Maybe you do an acqui-hire. Maybe you join forces. And I think that's a harder option for a lot of the founders because there's a lot of emotion tied to that. I give every founder gets so much credit, yourself too. When you start a business, you're taking a risk that very few people are. And you should be admired for that. But I think that those are the options. I think you have to be data-driven. And it's social proofing because you have a great quote and a great LinkedIn presence doesn't, I don't think, will work in the next 2 years.
Spot on insights. I mean, this has been an amazing conversation, Rizbeh, and really enjoyed hanging out with you on the show today. I appreciate you taking the time and gain a lot of value from the conversation as always. You know, the interactions we've had have always been very valuable. For our listeners to, you know, listening to the show today, who would like to reach out, who would like to pick your brains, who would like to connect and learn more, and hopefully some of these topics resonated. I know they certainly resonated with me. What's the best way for them to get in touch?
Yeah, I think the best way is two formats. You can find me on LinkedIn, Rizbeh Rotabi. The company that I started a few months ago is called Aval Advisory. Some context there. Aval means first in Farsi, which is in the language of Iran. So we try to come in and help and build the tools, the systems, the people, the execution model. So it's Rizbeh Rotabi. My email is lastnamefirstname@gmail.com. So rotabirizbeh@gmail.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to chat, grab a coffee if you're local or if I'm in your neighborhood, and talk all things leadership, startup, go-to-market, operational execution. So I've enjoyed the time together. I appreciate you giving me some airtime, and I look forward to seeing you at one of the other Pavilion events or the Stage 2 events very soon.
Awesome. Rizbeh, looking forward to it. Appreciate you.
By uncovering blind spots in performance, motivation, and skills, UHubs helps busy sales leaders at top SaaS companies to optimize their sales enablement so they can develop their reps and grow revenue. The UHubs Pulse platform visualizes each team's development needs, personalized upskilling, and provides data-driven coaching recommendations. These save sales managers 40-plus hours per quarter and help reps to ramp up 30% faster. Supercharge your sales team by booking a demo today.